So good evening, everyone, and hope that you're all doing well and hopefully better than I am with this COVID smoke that's been in the air for the last few days, which provides some challenge to my breathing. By God willing, I'll keep breathing until we're finished. The title that we have tonight, The Gifts of the Jews, may be somewhat similar to a talk I gave a year ago in September 2019 entitled The Covenant That Defined the World. And maybe it's a bit presumptuous on my part to think that you remember any of it. But anyway, at that time, we concentrated on the achievements of Israel as a nation and upon the Jews, mostly including things like technology, medical technology, agricultural technology, numbers of Jews who received Nobel Prizes, etc. And these advancements, of course, continue unabated even today, including this recent piece that I saw the other day in a news article. And there's all kinds of these. We could fill a whole night with them. For example, Urban Aeronautics CEO announced last week that they have designed a made-in-Israel flying car. Now, that I'm sure would be really useful to most of us. But however, it's technology that continues to expand. Four different Israeli green companies have band together and are producing products and processes that they say will change the world. Interesting. Israel's Real View Corporation is looking to revolutionize medical imaging with live holography. So last November, a couple of months after I gave that talk, we were walking through a bookstore downtown with our son, Stephen. When Stephen comes to visit, we go downtown to bookstores. I found this book. It was marked down from $21.95 to $7.99, and Stephen said he'd heard of it and encouraged me to buy it, which I did, thinking that, sort of mistakenly, that this was going to be another book of something like the previous lecture that I had given. I was somewhat surprised, actually, when I finally got to read it some months later, probably a COVID read, as I remember it. And I found out that there was a very different presentation in the book. Thomas Cahill, I believe, is a Jew, although there's nothing in the book that seems to indicate that he is or he isn't. But certainly he is writing with great praise for the Jews. How a tribe of desert nomads changed the way everyone thinks and feels. And this is sort of how it develops. He says the Jews started it all. And by it, I mean so many of the things that we care about, the underlying values that make us, make all of us, Jew and Gentile, believers and atheists, make us tick. The underlying values. Without Jews, he says, we would see the world through different eyes, hear with different ears, even feel with different feelings. And not only would our sensorium, the screen through which we receive the world, be different, we would think with a different mind. We would interpret all of our experience differently. We would draw different conclusions from the things that befall us. And we would set a different course for our lives. He goes on to say, by we, I mean the usual we of late 20th century writing, the people of the Western world, whose peculiar but vital mentality has come to infest every culture on, so that in a startlingly precise sense, all humanity is now willy-nilly caught up in the we. For better or worse, the role of the West in humanity's history is singular. Because of this, the role of the Jews, the inventors of Western culture, is also singular. There is simply no one else remotely like them. No one else remotely like them. Theirs is a unique vocation, which is a word that we will come back to, God willing, in a few moments. Theirs is a unique vocation. Indeed, as we shall see, the very idea of vocation, of a personal destiny, is a Jewish idea. There is simply no one else remotely like them, he says. Theirs is a unique vocation. Indeed, as we shall see, the very idea of vocation, of a personal destiny, is in fact a Jewish idea. So the history is replete, our history is replete, with examples of those who have refused to see what the Jews are actually about, who through intellectual blindness, racial chauvinism, xenophobia, or just plain evil, have been unable to give this oddball tribe, this ragtag band, this race of wanderers who are the progenitors of the Western world, their due. Indeed, at the end of this bloodiest of all centuries, of course referring to last century, we can all too easily look back on scenes of unthinkable horror perpetrated by those who would do anything, rather than give the Jews their due. And further, he says that the Jews gave us the outside and the inside. The Jews gave us our outlook and our inner life. We can hardly get up in the morning or cross the street without being Jewish, he says. We dream Jewish dreams and we hope Jewish hopes. Most of our best words, in fact, are the gifts of the Jews. And here's a short list of them. The word new, adventure, he suggests, are completely unique to Jewish faith and Jewish writings. The word surprise, unique. And I think we'll understand that a little bit as we go farther into this word study. But the thought that we could have in any day a surprise, or that we could do something that's unique and different and new. And here's three words that are very important, I think. Individual, person, and vocation. Which means, according to Cahill, that the human being, you and I, are individuals. We're not like people who live in other cultures that are sort of submerged into the mass with a common thought, a common view, but we are individual. We've been created in the likeness of God. We've been created as persons to have names, not only to be individuals with names, but to also have a vocation, which means that the God who created us said, this is who you are, and this is what I want you to do. You've got a job to do, an individual job. So individualism is a gift to mankind from the Jews. Now, if we think of individualism, person, vocation, we also can couple this with this Jewish concept of time. The Jewish concept of time is past, present, and future. As we'll see, the thinking of the Jewish mind is that there was a past and that their lives are rooted in the past. They apply that to the present to order their lives, and all of that looks forward to a future. Two more words that come into play, and the first one is freedom and the second one is progress. Because if we're individuals and we're people, special people with names, with vocations, then we also have to have choice. We have to have freedom to express, and that also implies that there's progress. So we change. Because of this gift from God, which he calls the gift of the Jews, we understand our life in terms of past, present, and future. We understand our life in terms of vocation, which means choice and freedom and progress. when we have progress, when we have freedom, when we have the understanding of ourselves as creations of God, individual, with freedom and progress, then we have faith. We also have a spirit. And from that, we have hope and justice. So here's just, I'm sure, a short list of words that he throws out that are uniquely Jewish in concept, that give us the outside and the inside, our outlook and our inner life. And amazingly, he says, we can hardly get up in the morning or cross the street without being Jewish. One way or the other, we are this. And most of our best words are gifts from the Jews. Now that raises the next question. What about the world before the Jews? If the Jews come to us with all these gifts, what was the world like before that and before the need for these gifts, if you like? So we have to go back into the past and look at it and say, well, what was the need for a change? What was going on in history before the Jews? And he starts, and he spends some considerable time with the ancient civilization of Mesopotamia, as we'll see in a few moments. He wants us to understand that the world, what the world was like before the Jews, and this is important. Now, we can look at the world before the Jews in four or five different time spans. Most familiar to most of us listening right now would be from Eden to Mesopotamia. There was, by the time we get to the civilizations in Mesopotamia, very advanced, sophisticated cultures. Advanced, well, we can't necessarily use the word advanced, but certainly religious procedures and systems and life management systems in Mesopotamia. We'll get back to that in a moment. But of course, at the same time, there were civilizations, advanced civilizations in China in the similar time period, and also in Egypt. We're probably more familiar with Mesopotamia and Egypt, but certainly China with their 3,000 years, 4,000 years BC at the time of the Mesopotamian culture. And we've thrown in from Eden to Stonehenge, that's another period of time. And Stonehenge is just there because most of us are sort of Westerners in the sense that we came from Europe and came through Britain and Europe. So Stonehenge is one of our kind of monuments and representations of time. But we can't also ignore the period from Eden to the Americas, because 1,000-2,000 years before Christ, as we understand time, there were fairly sophisticated cultures in the Americas. But they all, I'm sure we can demonstrate this. We don't have time tonight to do it in each one of these cultures, but we can all demonstrate that they have a very common belief system. They have a very common sense of ideas about life. They're very, very similar. And beginning where Cahill does in Uruk, which is modern Warka in Iraq, where city life actually began more than 5,000 years ago, and where the first writing emerged, was clearly one of the most important places in southern Mesopotamia, which was a great civilization there, which is sort of in the eastern part of Iraq. Within Uruk, the greatest monument was the Anu Ziggurat, in which the White Temple was built. Now, the discovery was in the 19th century. They know where this was. They have a pretty good idea of what it looked like, dating back to the late 14th millennium BC. This was dedicated to the sky god, Anu. This temple would have towered well above the flat plain of Uruk. It's very foundational to how worship was conducted, what the people saw as the basis of worship. And as we said, this was dedicated to the sky god, Anu. So there was worship of the heavens, the sun, moon, and the stars. And this is actually a common phrase in the Bible relating to all the nations around had similar beliefs in the sun, moon, and the stars. The Mesopotamian cosmology was extremely important in how we understand where many of these concepts came from. In Sumerian religion, some of the most powerful, important deities in the pantheon were the seven gods who decree, and so on. And there was many more. K.L. talks about Mesopotamia because our main source of ancient thought actually comes from Mesopotamian culture, unearthed from layers of civilization, a remarkably sophisticated culture, including, we might add, hot and cold running water. We're going back 6,000 years of known history, the very beginning, as far as we know, of literature and writing. And a lot of this information can be deducted from a novel called The Epic of Gilgamesh. And in it, we have an outline of the civil order, and especially an understanding of the ancient worship of the Sumerians. That worship was primarily based on the known canopy of the heavens, because they had a fairly limited knowledge of the heavens, as opposed to, say, how we understand the heavens today. Especially moon worship. They were able to track the changes of the moon. So the ancients looked up and observed the heavens and concocted an elaborate set of religious rituals in a vain attempt to communicate with the gods, these being primarily the sun god, the moon god, and hundreds of other gods that they brought into other aspects of life. In short, the people wrote the narrative about the relationship between the earth and the heavens. The rituals concentrated on human sexuality, on human sacrifice, burning children, and the contrasting elements of light and darkness, the moon cycles being central to their worship. And why not? It was relatively easy to track the moon and relate to rising tides and changing seasons. As I mentioned, this Epic of Gilgamesh predated Greek writing by 800 years. This Sumerian Babylonian poetic work stands as the oldest piece of epic literature. And it was, of course, an epic about this guy Gilgamesh, the mythological hero king of Uruk, and his half-wild friend Enkidu, as they undertake a series of dangerous quests and adventures. And then Gilgamesh's search for the secret of immortality after the death of his friend. It originated the series of Sumerian legends, the poems in cuneiform script dating back to the early 3rd to late 2nd millennium BCE. This was ancient religion. This is the way people thought. This is the way they conceived of life and of the world around them. The Egyptians, roughly the same time and forward, had over 2,000 deities in their pantheon. And these 2,000 deities all represented some integral part of people's daily lives. They had gods for everything, literally everything. Ancient Egyptian culture grew out of an understanding of these deities and the vital role they played in the immortal journey of every human being. Great pyramids, celebrations of death, worship centered in the sun, the moon, and the stars, common to Mesopotamian belief. And here's a short list of some of the more important or more well-known Egyptian gods. The Greeks, I have to admit, and I think Cahill does in his book, were really the best of the bunch at this. They had all kinds of gods and all kinds of designations of gods. They had the 12 Titans. They had this list, which I've got really small printed here because I don't expect you to read it all. I also have below that another 15 or 20 or 30 Greek gods that I could send to you, but you can Google all this. You don't have to worry about that. The sources are all there. Titans of this and titans of that and titans of so on. So what you did in your daily life in Greece was that you identified with your issues of life with one or the other of these gods. And I guess you appealed to them But in Greek, the Greek mythology, of course, was also temple related. And temple relations in Greek were largely ritual called prostitution. This is the main activity. Something we need to understand as we move forward in this, the Greek pantheon is very much with us today. So I say the Greeks have done a much better job of creating something that is lasting. They follow the same themes and narratives of the Epic of Gilgamesh, really, and the rest of the mythology. And we have to understand that if our kids play video games today, they are probably dealing with ancient gods and goddesses waging war. And you can Google this too and find out how many video games actually involve Greek mythology and Greek gods and goddesses. They have lots of fans today. If your kids play video games, they will be without doubt immersed in Greek mythology. And it's not only that, but Greek mythology is everywhere. It's on the door of Starbucks and so on brands worldwide. An endless fascination with Greek titans and Olympian gods and so on of mythology. And again, I said we can throw in Stonehenge because what we know about Stonehenge is it's an early form of earthwork, a henge which they added circles of stone to much later. And it's undoubtedly there aligned to the rising sun at midsummer and the setting sun at midwinter. So it was like a clock to them. They carried on their rituals and worship of the sun as the sun rotated around special views through these stones. Not all stone circles were aligned on heavenly bodies, but it's clear that the procession of time and seasons and the movements of the sun and moon were highly significant to prehistoric people. This is the world before the gifts of the Jews. This was the world that in a strange way follows through into the life that we're living today in our modern world. The final couple of comments from Cahill. In the revolving drama of the heavens, primitive people saw an immortal wheel-like pattern that was predictive of mortal life. At the center of this wheel of life, they found the hub of death. The correspondences they discern between earth and heavenly realities are pictured in their earliest art. The spirals, the zigzag, the lodges, the abounding almost everywhere in the most ancient monuments left to us, we can see all of these icons and drawings. The spiral, ever turning, ever beginning again, is the image of the cyclical nature of reality and so on, of the phases of the moon, the changing of the season, the cycle of a woman's body, the ever-turning wheel of birth, copulation, and death. The zigzags sometimes represent lightning, which was associated with the moon, because the moon was thought to control all water and fertility, and lightning precedes a storm, and so on. But most anciently, zigzags are the symbol of flowing water, found on Neolithic pottery and among the oldest hieroglyphs of Egypt. This is what the world was like. This is how people conceived of things in the ancient world. And again, I'm sure that most video games and many movies today are based on the characterizations of ancient myths, of the heroes of ancient mythology, of the struggle, blow by blow, reincarnation by reincarnation, defeat by defeat, victory by victory, hero by hero, winning and losing. An endless wheel of life, death, birth, copulation, and death continuing. It's a great struggle for some reason, great fascination to human beings from the beginning of time. But then the world changed forever. I think this is what we need to focus on. And how did the world change forever? What was one of the greatest gifts of the Jews? Well, it was Abraham. And when we come to Abraham, we have the first recorded event of a personal relationship between a person and their God. This seems to be the only time this shows up, the first time this shows up in history. The first time a God called out to a man. So this personal relationship was established because a God called out to a man, and this was one God, not 2,000 gods, but one God called out to a man. It's the first time a relationship of faith is defined. This faith developed between a God, one God, and a man that was called out. The first time a relationship of love is defined. And this man who God called out was told to take his son, his only son, the son he loved, up into a mountain at God's command. This is the first time love is used, the word love, the concept of love. The first time we began to understand the past, the present, and the future, because Abraham was called out from somewhere. He had a past. It was in Ur. And in Mesopotamia and all the idolatry and all that went on there was called out. That was his past to a present in the promised land, given promises that related to a future. So Abraham was the first to see past, present, and future in the record. And so the first time a future is defined, a future hope is defined because the promises that were made to Abraham spoke of a time to come, a future to come. So it was Moses as well as Abraham. Not just Abraham, but Moses as another one of these individuals who changed the world, who helped to change the world. Now, of course, we say that Moses brought us the Ten Commandments, but they were obviously from God. But think about this. I have divided the Ten Commandments into a top five, which I relate to God, and a bottom five, which relate to human beings. But here's the concept that's so different from where Abraham was. No other gods before me. Not thousands of gods, but only one God. And a focus on no other gods before me. And no graven images, as we saw in some of the slides. Graven images that were everywhere in ancient civilization. Don't do it. No graven image. You don't need to make. There's only one God. Don't misuse the name of God. This is personal. Between people and God. Number four, remember the Sabbath day, and I'd like to come back to that in a few moments. This was hugely impactful on the world. Honor your father and mother. Now, this didn't exist really in ancient cultures where you burned your children or you offered sacrifice of your children. It didn't give you much time to honor your father and mother. This is one of the glues of society, which is one of the gifts, as Cahill says, of the Jews. The bottom five are about man, and they're rather more simple than what we often think, because the original text, from what I understand, would say something like, no murder, no adultery, no stealing, no lying, no coveting. So remember we said that Cahill said, well, you know, the Jews have brought us the inside and the outside, the concept of the inside and the outside. So if you look at murder and adultery and stealing and lying, these are things that you do on the outside. But coveting is something you do on the inside. So this is a concept of the whole person, the inside and the outside. The person who has no other gods but one, who doesn't live with graven images like the Egyptians who had over 2,000 or the Greeks who had, I don't know, 5 million, who knows. An honor and respect for this one God and an honor and respect for father and mother. These were gifts of the Jews. But there were laws too, gifts of the Jews. Think of slavery. Slavery has been a curse on this earth from the beginning of time. It's a brutal, normally a brutal mishandling of humans by humans. And sadly, it goes on today. We have lots of evidence of slavery being practiced today in this world. where we live. And here's a point, Exodus 21, verse 26 to 27, when a man strikes the eye of a slave, male or female, and destroys it, he shall let the slave go free because of his eye. No, it's not a tooth, the slave, male or female, shall let the slave go because of the tooth. Now, this puts into law a relationship that exists between master and servant, master and slave. So you could write into here any type of thing, abuse or accidental happening between a master and a slave that resulted in some damage to the slave, he gets to go free. It's completely and totally revolutionary. And certainly wouldn't do well in the slave markets. You shall not pervert the justice due to the sojourner or the fatherless or take a widow's garment in pledge, but you shall remember. And here's why they were to treat people properly as slaves. Here's why this was written into labor law and labor code, because they, descendants of Abraham, were slaves in Egypt, and the Lord had redeemed them from there. And so therefore, they had to keep in mind what it was like to be slaves, and therefore treat people with honor and respect as God had told them. There were laws regarding health and cleanliness, lots and lots of them. And here's one that probably you might relate to easier than some of the others. You shall have a place outside the camp and you shall go out to it. And when you have a toilet, you have a trowel with your tools. And when you sit down outside, you dig a hole and you turn it back and cover it up your excrement. Amazing. You know, this is one issue of public health that wasn't even fully understood right up until the 18th and 19th century in Europe. Another gift of the Jews, of cleanliness, labor management. King Solomon built a huge temple, but he also was involved in massive construction projects in Israel. He drafted forced labor out of Israel, and the draft numbered 30,000 men, and he sent them up to Lebanon primarily to cut trees for his loggers. And they had to leave home and go up to cut trees. He sent them up 10,000 a month in shifts, which meant they worked a month on and 2 months off. They went back home for 2 months. Amazing, amazing laws regarding labor management, gifts from the Jews. And this is one that I think we can all relate to. Remember the Sabbath day. The Sabbath day came from the Jews. I remember a world that was largely based on slavery. The Sabbath day meant a day off. It's the most amazing thing, most revolutionary thing, that you would actually have a day off. And the day off was about not a slowdown, if you read this. It's about a lockdown. It's about 6 days. The Lord made the heaven and the earth, the sea, and all that is in it, and he rested on the seventh day. Therefore, this is etched in Jewish law and Jewish consciousness. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. You don't do anything. You just take the day off, which meant that an all-knowing and an all-seeing Creator God recognized that people needed a day off. I have to kind of interject this before we close this tonight, that the sad fact was that the Jews didn't follow these laws. The sad fact is that the Jews had this propensity to constantly want to go back to the world before Abraham, which was the world that was being practiced around them. And so the prophets had to come along, and Jeremiah says in chapter 2, verse 11 to 13, has a nation changed its gods, even though they are no gods? But my people have changed their glory for that which does not profit. This is what Josh read for us from the first chapter of Romans tonight. Be appalled, O heavens, at this. Be shocked and utterly desolate, declares the Lord, for my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of the living waters, and hewed out cisterns for themselves and broken cisterns that can hold no water. This is the tragic story of Israel after being given these gifts that changed the world, that would have made their lives amazingly prosperous and comfortable, they kept wanting to go back. Moses said to them in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 19, "Beware lest you raise your eyes to heaven. And when you see the sun and the moon and the stars and all the hosts of heaven," that's what they used to worship and what they did before Abraham, "and you be drawn away and bow down to them and serve them, things the Lord your God has allotted to all the peoples under the whole heaven." They all do that, but you're not to do that. The Lord has taken you and brought you out of the iron furnace out of Egypt to be a people of his own inheritance, as you are this day. That's an interesting thing that happened there. Well, anyway, finally, the Apostle Paul, one of the most prolific writers in the New Testament, if not the most, was a Jew. Paul understood these gifts from the Jews. He writes about it in Romans chapter 9, verse 1 to 5, as he kind of reminisces, because he had a struggle with Israel, the Jews, in relation to the gospel that was now going forth, and he was preaching it. And so what did he see about the Jews? Well, first of all, he said that the Jews are my kinsmen. They're his flesh and blood. This was a great gift to Paul because he could trace back his ancestry to his tribe. He was the tribe of Benjamin. The first king of Israel was from the tribe of Benjamin. Jews were his flesh and blood. He valued them. Not only were Jews his flesh and blood, but Israel and the Israelites were the people of the adoption, Paul says. Again, Romans chapter 5, verse 1, 9, verses 1 to 5. Israelites were the adoption because God adopted the nation of Israel to be his chosen people. This is a special thing. This is a special gift, really, as Paul saw it. To the Jews was the gift of glory. Now, the glory of God actually existed physically in something called the Shekinah glory. It was a light in the tabernacle. It was the light that existed in the temple in Jerusalem for hundreds of years. When you thought of the Israelites, and he thought of them as his kinsmen, he could only think as well of the glory of God that had actually been revealed. He thought of the covenants when he was thinking of the gifts of the Jews. The covenants of promise were actually made to the whole world, that the blessings of Abraham would be inherited one day by all the world. So the covenants were not just for Israel. The covenants were there to help to change the world, to make the idolatrous world think differently. Well, one of the gifts of the Jews, Paul says, was the giving of the law. We've looked at the Ten Commandments. We've looked at some other issues within the law. This was an amazing gift to the world by the Jews. He said the worship, now think of the worship of the Jews, was holy. It wasn't the temple that they built. It was not for cult prostitution. It was a holy place. It was a sanctified place. You needed that kind of a place if you're going to relate individually to one God. Paul loved that about the Jews. That was a great gift, the understanding of the sanctity and the holiness of the temple. The promises, well, we come to that at the end of this, because the promises that were the gift of the Jews related to the Messiah that would come. Promises that were made to begin with to the patriarchs and repeated to many others and repeated to the nation over and over about the ultimate plan of God, of his glory, the Messiah, the Lord Jesus Christ. Paul sees at the end of this amazing list of gifts for the Jews, this was all about Jesus Christ. The greatest gift of the Jews to the world, says Paul, is Jesus. And he says in his opening chapter of his letter to the church at Rome, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God to salvation, for everyone who believes, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. So you see how this great gift to Abraham and all of these great gifts to Abraham focus in the end to you and I. To the fact that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. And Paul saw this Messiah as being the ultimate fulfillment of all of the gifts and the major gifts, gift of the Jews. This also, of course, illustrates the personal relationship. This illustrates the connected relationship. This illustrates the encompassing arc of time, past, present, and future. The most important Jewish writer of all times, the Apostle Paul, summarizing the gifts of the Jews, their personal relationship to himself, their relationship to you and I, or you and me. He understood the greatest gift of the Jews. That gift is the gift of God to all mankind, his son Jesus Christ. He reaches down through time to share that gift with us. Jesus is the hope of new life. Jesus is the promise of victory over death. And this, friends, is the call to action. Jesus is the greatest gift of the Jews. He is the best hope of the world. He is the only hope of the world. And yes, this is personal. Have you accepted him as your Savior?